I'm John Dennis. It's Friday the 21st of August. Today, state school students feel the squeeze in the scramble for university places.
Half of A-levels awards in private schools got an A this year, compared to 20% in comprehensives.
Fury in South Africa as its gold medal winning athlete faces questions about her sex.
It's something she's faced all her life. She was teased at school.
And the influence of Kind of Blue, Miles Davis's masterpiece from 1959.
The kind of repeated ostinatos, which did away with chords, you know, did away with chord sequences, and thus really transmitting to another idiom what they'd picked up from Kind of Blue.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton's got the news and today's papers.
Barack Obama has condemned Scotland's release of the convicted Lockerbie bomber Abdel Basset al-Megrahi. The US president's called it a mistake and says the US has opened talks with Libya, urging the regime to keep Megrahi under house arrest until his death. The Scottish government released the 57-year-old, who has terminal cancer, on compassionate grounds. Most of the 270 people who died in the bombing were Americans, and relatives have also expressed their anger at the release. Votes are being counted in Afghanistan after violent attacks during Election Day left at least 26 people dead. Despite millions of Afghans turning out to vote, turnout was thought to be low in the most violent parts of the Pashtun South. Taliban fighters launched sporadic rocket, suicide and bomb attacks, closing many election sites. But President Hamid Karzai and his Western allies are declaring the poll a success, and the UN's reported the majority of polling stations were able to operate peacefully. President Karzai is hoping for re-election and faces about 30 challenges. Official results are not expected for 2 weeks. Domestic violence victims will be able to get greater protection from courts in England and Wales from next month. Judges will have powers to impose restraining orders on abusers charged with any offence, even if they're cleared but still considered a threat. Victims are currently often forced to go through civil courts to secure such an injunction, even if, for example, a partner is convicted of assault. In sport, England resume on 307 for 8 on day 2 of the deciding Ashes test. And Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt took another world record yesterday when he won the 200-metre final at the World Championships. Bolt set a time of 19.19 seconds to demolish the previous record of 19.3 he set last summer in Beijing. He's now the first man to hold the 100 and 200-metre world and Olympic titles all at the same time. Taking a look now at today's papers, the release of Abdel Basset al-Megrahi, the man accused of the Lockerbie bombing, the story dominating most front pages. Home to a hero's welcome, reports both The Times and The Mail, with The Times warning the decision to release him was compassionate but wrong. The Guardian quotes the sister of one of the men who died on Flight 103 to New York, who says the image of Megrahi boarding the plane home will live with me forever. And The Telegraph leads with the news of Obama's fury over the decision by the Scottish Justice Minister. Also on the front page of The Telegraph is a British Chinook helicopter shot down by the Taliban in Afghanistan. Yesterday's A-level results make some of the front pages, with The Times noting that exam chiefs say new marking methods might be needed because so many pupils are now getting an A grade. For all those stories and more throughout the day, keep up to date at guardian.co.uk.
Celebrations or commiserations? 350,000 students now know their A-level results. Here's some of them at St Kenneth's School in Caerphilly.
My first IT, I got a B. My second IT, I got an A. And then third and fourth is a C and a D. I'm quite happy as the A's and B's. Lovely.
I think if you haven't got what you wanted, there's always something else out there you can do. You know, it's not be all and end all university, but you know, it is great to get in and it does feel good to get in.
So I got my double distinction in performing arts, which I was hoping for, and it's D in geography, which I'm absolutely can't believe because I thought I was going to fail it, and an E in IT, which is more unbelievable. I did okay, I'm glad.
Record numbers of A-level students got A grades this year. But there were a disproportionately high number of pupils from fee-paying schools getting top marks. So those educated in state schools are finding it particularly hard to get a place at university, as our education editor Polly Curtis explains.
We've got what we expected, a huge increase in applications, 10%, but we've got an even bigger increase in the top grades than we expected, 0.8 percentage point increase, 26.5% of A-levels now awarded an A, which means that there's really, really stiff competition. And what's concerning some people today and the picture that's emerging that we're talking about today is about private schools and how they have increased at disproportionately high rate. So half of A-levels awarded in private schools got an A this year compared to 20% in comprehensives. And when you've got this huge competition and the gap widening between private and state schools, private school kids are going to cement their hold over the university places. And all the efforts that have been made over the last 10 years to encourage kids from poorer backgrounds could be reversed, you know, just because there aren't enough places.
Is there any leeway for admissions officers to apply a bit of discretion and allow, you know, state schools to have some sort of preference if he's faced with two similar students?
Well, all that kind of flexibility has gone out the window this year. So what students were finding yesterday was that when they missed their place just by one grade in previous years, you could call up the admissions tutor and basically talk your way in. This year, there was no kind of space for that because everybody was meeting their grades and because there were so many applicants.
Polly Curtis. Well, Tom Lord went to the £17,000 a year Brighton College. He needed three A grades to get into Lincoln College, Oxford.
I got three A's and I'm absolutely over the moon.
Oh, congratulations. How do you feel?
I'm delighted. I'm also relieved. I just, combination of feelings really, because I felt really as if I was blinkered, focusing on results day. Everything afterwards seemed such a long way off and I wasn't really thinking about it. And now it's almost got this overwhelming feeling of what to do now. And I'm just amazed at the opportunity before me and I'm really anticipating it and I'm really excited.
Now, university admissions staff are taking record numbers of calls from students hoping to secure a place through clearing, as Rachel Williams reports from the University of East London.
Charlotte Parslow is a senior lecturer in the School of Health and Bioscience and one of the admissions tutors in Professional Science, a department which offers very, very popular courses in subjects including physiotherapy and podiatric medicine. Charlotte, what's it been like here this morning since you got in?
Well, it's been really busy. People have been here since before 8 o'clock and the phones have just been ringing continuously. Literally, as soon as you've spoken to one applicant, you put the phone down and it's ringing again. It's just been much, much busier than we've seen before.
And people have been saying that, you know, this is obviously because there'll be a greater shortage of places this year, more people going through clearing looking for a smaller number of places. Can you sense a different feeling among the students who are actually calling in?
Yes, I think people are really, they are looking for a new education, a new career change that really is going to give them some future-proofing to their career. And certainly we've been having applicants ringing, not only those that have the current qualifications to get on the programmes, but those that are looking for advice for applying next year. So people are well ahead of the game, really looking to the future to change their career.
And what about the way that people are on the phone? Do people seem more anxious than they have been in the past, more panicky? Can you sense that?
No, everybody's been very positive so far, but I think people are really taking on board the advice this time. Often people ring up and if you can't give them a place because they don't have the right academic qualifications or profile, they're often a little disappointed with that. But obviously we've been offering a lot of advice this year about how to go about getting into the university and the other courses that we offer that might lead to entry. And people really seem to be keen to take that advice on board and go with that. So it's been great.
Rachel Williams, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/education. Also on The Guardian's website today, Jack Schenker reports from Egypt's Nile Delta, one of the places in the world most vulnerable to flooding and the most densely populated. guardian.co.uk/environment. Joanna Moorhead on the nightmare of letting your teenagers go on holiday with their friends. Have your say on that at guardian.co.uk/travel. And Emine Sainer celebrates 100 years of the Girl Guides. guardian.co.uk/women. On Wednesday, the South African Caster Semenya won the gold medal in the 800 metres at the World Athletics Championships in Berlin. But her muscular physique and extraordinary performances on the track have triggered speculation that she might in fact be a man. The International Association of Athletics Federations, the world governing body for athletics, has asked South Africa to test the 18-year-old's sex. David Smith's The Guardian's correspondent in Johannesburg.
South Africa is not very happy. They say it's motivated by jealousy and an unwillingness to give credit where it's due. And that goes all the way from Caster Semenya's own parents, who are rather upset and saying, she's our little girl, and we raised her, never doubted her gender. Just because she enjoyed playing football doesn't mean that she's not a woman. It goes all the way from them through to the government, the ruling African National Congress, led by President Jacob Zuma, have issued a statement saying that it's all rather bad form. And, you know, she's not the first female athlete who looks a bit muscular and, you know, get off her back and celebrate a rare South African success in athletics.
I mean, she's only 18. It must be a very difficult time for her, even though it should be a happy time. She just won a gold medal.
Yes, it's it's not what you want, having just won a race, to have this kind of attention, which some people around her says, you know, can potentially be a bit nasty and harmful to her self-esteem and self-respect. People have been saying that it's something she's faced all her life. She was teased at school by some of the other pupils because she was playing football and often playing with the boys, and her whole former head teacher is saying that she never wore a skirt, she always wore trousers.
Have the athletics governing bodies been suspicious of her before now?
Only as of about 3 weeks ago, they have obviously requested this gender verification test. And, you know, it's prompted because she has come out of nowhere. She was an unknown, and then suddenly ran a very quick time, 1 minute 56, at the African Junior Championships in Mauritius a few weeks ago, and that's the fastest time in the world this year. And when somebody does that, we've seen it all before with athletes suddenly improving and questions being asked about potential drug use. It sets the alarm bells ringing, and that's what seems to have happened here. And the fact that she won the 800 metres final on Wednesday in Berlin in such style and such a large gap ahead of the next athlete clearly is not going to quell those rumours in a hurry.
David Smith, well, I'm not a medical expert, but isn't it obvious whether someone's a male or female? Sarah Bosley's our health editor.
No, it's not obvious at all. And there are, in fact, models walking around the streets who are, from their chromosomes, actually male. They have the XY chromosomes. But in fact, because they've had a hormone complication, their body is unable to do anything with testosterone, actually blocks testosterone, they can look exactly like women and be like women in every respect, almost every respect, except their inability to have a baby.
So what test might one apply to decide whether someone's a man or a woman?
Well, according to endocrinologists, that's hormone specialists with whom I've been speaking, you need to look first of all at the chromosomal makeup of this person. So basically, are they XX or XY from birth? That's the starting block. So XX is, of course, a woman and XY is a man. Now, then you have to look at their hormone levels. So you see whether they have got the normal amounts of testosterone and estrogen, other hormones circulating in their body. Those, of course, do vary. I mean, there will be women who have more testosterone than men do. So it's not as simple as it sounds. And then you also have to look at the gonads. You look at whether their reproductive organs are the right ones and whether they're functioning properly. So all those things are variable.
Caster Semenya, then, may just have a lot of testosterone.
It's quite possible that that Caster, yes, has. This could be somebody who was actually born as XY and simply has more testosterone than most people do. We just don't know. And this is the thing that's got to be decided. Also, say she did have XY instead of XX, it still wouldn't necessarily debar her from running as a woman. You still have to make the decision not just on that simple chromosomal fact, but also on the hormones that are running in the body because of the variations that there can be.
Sarah Bosley. Well, I'm a male, my name's John Dennis, and still to come on Guardian Daily, David Cameron attempts to regain the initiative for the Tories over the National Health Service.
There were times in earlier years when the Conservatives toyed with private health insurance vouchers and all that sort of stuff. That is political suicide, so David Cameron has made very clear that the Conservatives are completely committed to the NHS.
But first, a couple of months ago, Leon Panetta, director of the CIA, told Congress that his agency had a secret programme of assassination of terror suspects abroad. Well, now it's been reported that the CIA hired the private security contractor Blackwater to kill Al-Qaeda leaders. Peter Beaumont has the details.
Well, it's not entirely clear yet how far this plan went, but the idea that they were looking into was to subcontract the assassination of Al-Qaeda operatives to Blackwater. I mean, that's what's known. What's not known is how far the programme went. I mean, clearly there were no assassinations, but the controversy seems to be over the fact that this was hidden from Congress, and that is what's been the issue. I mean, this has been the story that's been bubbling for some weeks now about this covert programme that when the new director, Leon Panetta, discovered what it was, he felt that he had then to brief Congress on this issue.
President Gerald Ford passed a law.
Yeah, he signed an executive order banning these kind of operations. And that's always been the question with Blackwater. I mean, you know, why is it that they have been involved in so many things that appear to be, you know, military functions? I mean, Kofor Black, who used to be the director of counterterrorism at the CIA, who then went to work for Blackwater, I mean, he denies it, but is alleged to have boasted that, you know, that in 2006 that Blackwater could produce a brigade size of personnel for, you know, the suitable kinds of jobs. And it seems as though it was always Blackwater's ambition to push into doing sort of privatised military functions and intelligence functions. And people who've written about Blackwater's owner and founder, Eric Prince, I mean, have described how he was, you know, in and out of the CIA on a monthly basis, and particularly the Directorate of Operations.
What kind of things were Blackwater doing in Iraq?
In Iraq, I mean, they were originally contracted to do a protection job for US government personnel. A lot of the contracts that they were initially given, in fact, two-thirds of them were on a no-bid contract, so there was no competition for these contracts. They were simply awarded to them. And it's when Blackwater really came to prominence, both as a business and imprinted itself in the public mind. And you used to see them flying around in these little black helicopters above convoys or riding around on convoy duties, always very, very obvious, and kind of bandanas and, you know, these big muscly men sort of making no effort at discretion or a low profile. And they had a, you know, amongst other security contractors, particularly, you know, some of the British ones, I suppose, they had a bad reputation. I mean, they were, you know, their nickname amongst some people was Ditchwater.
Now that President Barack Obama is running the White House, what sort of things is Blackwater doing now for the US government?
Well, there was always this expectation that Blackwater would be pushed out of the scene because of its notoriety. But in fact, what's happened is that it's rebranded itself. It calls itself Z Services. And despite being banned by the Iraqi government from operating in Iraq, it's still alleged to operate there under the auspices of something called the US Training Center, which will continue until September. And under Barack Obama, there has been a large increase in the use of private military contractors in Afghanistan, and that includes Blackwater personnel.
Peter Beaumont. In a speech in Bolton yesterday, the Conservative leader David Cameron pledged to speed up Labour's healthcare reforms. And in an echo of George Osborne's claim last week that the Tories were the UK's most progressive party, Cameron claimed that the Conservatives were now the party of the NHS. The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Nicholas Watt, is in our Westminster office.
This was a week after the big row over the NHS, where Dan Hannan, the very right-wing Conservative MEP, described the NHS as a 60-year-old mistake, which was fantastically difficult and awkward for David Cameron, because one of the big things that he's done since he became leader in 2005 is to move the Conservative Party onto the centre ground. And one of the most important examples of that is making very clear that the Conservatives are wholeheartedly committed to the NHS, because there were times in earlier years when the Conservatives toyed with private health insurance vouchers and all that sort of stuff. That is political suicide. So David Cameron has made very clear that the Conservatives are completely committed to the NHS. And he did that in two ways. Firstly, he opened the speech with quite moving words about how the NHS is there for everybody when you get ill, regardless of your background, regardless of your wealth. And he also talked about how they're there, the NHS is there to help people you love. He didn't mention his son, his late son, Ivan, who died earlier this year, but it was pretty clear who he had in mind. But the second thing he said is he put up in lights how if the Conservatives win the next general election, then in the next spending round, that's from 2011 to 2014, they would guarantee that health spending would increase in line with inflation. They're the only party to have given that commitment. They gave that commitment a few months ago, but David Cameron went a little further yesterday and said to do anything less would be a backward step.
Did the online campaign We Love the NHS suggest that David Cameron was wrong to dismiss Twitter?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because a few weeks before this all came out, David Cameron, I think, wasn't the phrase he said, if you Twitter too much, you turn into a twat. I think that his use of language was seen as a bit of a mistake. Future prime ministers or possible prime ministers shouldn't use the word twat. But no, absolutely right. The Twitter campaign was a great success. It was a success. He says he agrees with it. Indeed, some of his members of staff Twittered themselves on that. So, yes, I suppose in retrospect, I imagine they're rethinking the twat outburst.
And finally, Nick, if I could ask you, what do you make of the politics behind Cameron's strong criticism yesterday of the decision by the Scottish Justice Minister to allow the Lockerbie bomber, the terminally ill Abdel Basset Al-Megrahi, to return home to Libya?
Well, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's not just David Cameron who criticised the release. The leader of the Labour Party in Scotland, Ian Gray, criticised it and said that if he was First Minister, it wouldn't have happened, overlooking the fact that the decision is not taken by the First Minister, it's taken by the Justice Secretary in Scotland. So, yes, I think what we can say from that is that the SNP, the main parties, obviously both in Scotland, because the other parties are much bigger when you put them together in Scotland, the SNP and the UK parties, the Liberal Democrats, the Conservatives and the Labour Party are highly critical of this decision.
Nicholas Watt. Kind of Blue by the trumpeter Miles Davis is the best-selling jazz album ever. Quincy Jones says he listens to it every day. 50 years after its release, The Guardian's Richard Williams has written a book about it, attempting to place Kind of Blue in a wider cultural context. He told Claire Armitstead for our books podcast about the album's far-reaching influence.
I'd point you to The Velvet Underground, which might seem unlikely because you could put a Velvet Underground record on and then put Kind of Blue on and think, what have those two got in common? Well, what they've got in common is John Cale, who was the Velvet Underground's electric viola player and pianist and sometimes bass guitarist, and who introduced to rock music through The Velvet Underground the kind of repeated ostinatos, which did away with chords, you know, did away with chord sequences, the kind of things that he'd picked up from his work with Terry Riley, with Lamont Young, the California minimalists, and thus really transmitting to another idiom what they'd picked up from Kind of Blue. So that would be one, you know, something like All Tomorrow's Parties by the Velvet Underground with its hammered piano. And I'd also point to Brian Eno's ambient music, music for airports, that sort of thing, which he invented as a kind of creative response to the sterility of Muzak. But Brian didn't hear Kind of Blue when it came out, but he knew about Miles Davis, but he really absorbed all this, like John Cale, through the minimalist composers.
Well, Richard, I'll definitely be brushing down my iPod, adding some new things to it. Just as a postscript, one intriguing fact that emerges from the book was that it was actually recorded at the wrong speed.
Half of it was one of the two sessions. The whole thing was recorded less than 9 hours in 2 days, a few weeks apart. And at one of the sessions, the tape machine was running slightly at the wrong speed. Now, they used two tape machines, one to make a copy for safety purposes to put in their vault for the archives, and one to use as the master copy. And the one that they made the master copy on was just running a fraction out of time.
So until 1993, we've been listening to the wrong thing.
A hair wrong. I mean, I think it's possible to make too much of that, but it's true. And they'd finally corrected it, and the one you would go into a shop and buy now would have the right speed.
Richard Williams, whose book The Blue Moment, Miles Davis's Kind of Blue and the Remaking of Modern Music, is published by Faber and Faber. Guardian Daily was produced today by Phil Maynard and Harriet Grant. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.